This episode of Ghost Stories is brought to you by Satrix, the leading provider of index tracking solutions in South Africa and a proud partner of Ghostmail. With no minimums and easy, low-cost access to local and global products via the Satrix Now online investment platform, everyone can own the market. Visit satrix.co.za for more information. Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast, and Sia Bulela Namoyi, he's back on the show from Satrix. Sia, you are a very familiar voice to listeners by now. And I think the last time we spoke was a few months ago, actually, and we were talking about, amongst other things, how well did that December savings plan go? I'm shocked to say that it's now after Easter. It feels like we spoke basically the other day. The first quarter is now behind us, and you and the team have been pretty busy at Satrix. There's been product launches. There's been all kinds of stuff going on. So thank you so much for making time for this today, particularly because I know how busy you guys actually are.
Yeah, awesome. Great to chat to you again, Mr. Ghost. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. Great to be here.
Yeah, so today we decided we are going to talk about bonds because the fixed income side of the market really doesn't get enough attention. And for me personally, I always think investors need to understand that there are many ways out there to construct a portfolio. There's been a lot of maturity in the market after the pandemic craziness when it was equities or nothing. These days, things are different. You know, we seem to be in a higher for longer interest rate environment, and we'll talk about some of that. There's lots of different ways to try and build wealth over time. And I think diversification is an important tool. You know, anyone who understands anything about investing and portfolio construction will tell you that diversification is useful. Yes, it is great to look back and say, oh, I should have put all my money in Apple. Hindsight is great and very easy, but that's not the way to build wealth over your lifetime. So, you know, we last spoke about bond investments, or the first time we actually covered it in detail on the show was in July 2023. I mean, that's almost a year ago, really, which is quite incredible. And I think at the time, one of the many topics we talked about there was balanced portfolios and the theory around why investors should consider adding bonds and fixed income exposure to a portfolio. So maybe we should start there with a bit of a refresher. In your view, what is the value of a balanced portfolio versus being pure equity? And is it something that everyone should consider, or is it for those with a lower risk tolerance than others?
Sure. Jeez, I'm just thinking about what you just said now, that time flies. I mean, when we're speaking about bonds in July 2023, that was a totally different environment back then, eh? For the first time since November 2021, I think our Reserve Bank paused on increasing rates, which is a very important component for our discussion today, particularly bonds. Inflation was at its lowest around 4.7, which is what the SARB tends to like more. They want to be in the middle of their range of 3 to 6. So that inflation is also important when it comes to talking about bonds and rates. So during that period, I mean, bonds started to pick up coming off a flat May, 12 months return. So quite strong returns in June and July. So definitely not in the same market conditions right now. So, but I tend to give long answers, Ghost. So please interject anytime. But to get back to your question on balanced funds or portfolios, I think just talking about the fluctuations in returns for many different asset classes, including bonds, it's quite clear that balanced portfolios play a very, very important role when it comes to things like risk management for your long-term investment plans. And bonds are an important asset class for these types of portfolios. So when you look or when you think about a balanced fund, it's in the name. You are sort of trying to balance between long-term sizable returns while you're trying to minimize drawdowns, or should we say reduce risk in your portfolio. So equities offer a lot of upside when you look at their long-term numbers. But along the way, there's a lot of volatility to stomach. And this is where people tend to panic, because they want to invest today and then tomorrow they want a 12% return on their investment. If you're looking at things like the all-share index, it can swing from giving you 29% returns or 30% returns in 1 year, and then the next day it's down 3%. So there's a lot of swings to stomach along the way when it comes to equities. So diversifying your portfolio, which is what a balanced fund actually should ideally do, is quite important. And this is what bonds and other asset classes bring to the table when it comes to them, when you put them together with an asset class like equities. So Some of your listeners will know of the classic 60-40 portfolio, investors holding 60% stocks, 40% bonds. I think we mentioned that in the July bond discussion last year as well. But yeah, balanced funds vary, which then talks to the risk tolerance you have mentioned, where you would get a high equity balanced fund, typically allocating around 70% equities and the rest to bonds and other asset classes. Then you get to a medium equity exposure, around 50% or so, and then lower equity balance funds, which give you about 30% of equities. And then most of that will go to like bonds and other asset classes within that. So there, equities sort of play like a striker role, pulling in returns or scoring goals for you when they need it in terms of the returns, while your bonds are actually like your midfield or your defense in your portfolio. So these help a lot in terms of generating totally different investment journeys for investors. And I'm happy to say that Certix also plays in this space, where we offer clients the option of getting exposure from our high equity balance fund, which is part of our excess range, and our low equity balance fund. Both of these are unit trusts and are both Regulation 28 compliant. So you can actually invest these on your retirement annuity.
And that 60-40 split, that is, of course, the traditional view. And look, you'll see lots of interesting stuff out there about how you should include commodities and alternatives and all of that kind of jazz. And that's probably a bigger conversation than we'll do today. But I think the lesson here is, well, certainly the view is, you know, you can't just be 100% equities, or you shouldn't just be 100% equities over the long term. And I think that what a lot of people don't realize is almost everyone already has a balanced portfolio. And what I mean by that is, if you have got a savings account right now and you've got money locked up for like 6 months or a year, what you've basically done is you've built your own little balanced portfolio, right? You've got your equities portfolio, and then you've got a fixed income investment. It just happens to be with your bank right now. And it happens to be for a term of 3 months or 6 months or 15 days notice. A bond is effectively just a longer version of that. Now, obviously, it's a lot more complicated, because the difference is your bank deposit, you will get back your capital plus that interest at the end of the term. Funnily enough, a bond is basically the same if you hold to maturity, as long as there's no credit loss event. But what happens with bonds that makes it complicated is the term, the lockup, is effectively way longer. And if you want to get out of it before that period, then you're exposed to changes in the capital value of the bond. And that's where this whole inverse relationship comes in, to say, you know, rates go up, bond prices come down, or rates go down, bond prices come up. And that creates these quite complicated return structures that are quite foreign to you if you've only really looked at equities. And then on top of that, you layer stuff like the higher for longer interest rate commentary coming out of the US right now. The Fed seems to be in no real hurry to cut rates, although who really knows what will happen there. Do you think some of these just macroeconomic complexities and this inverse relationship and all this kind of stuff contribute to investors struggling to get their heads around these fixed income portfolios? Because we know, and I think you shared the stats with us before, and I'm sure it's still the case, that the equity ETFs do get far more flows than a fixed income ETF. So I guess question one is, do you think that complexity is a contributing factor here? And then I think let's maybe dig into, you know, that relationship between rates and bond prices, and maybe a little bit of how you see this thing playing out.
Yeah, so I mean, the investment world can be intimidating, and it can get very complex very quick, which is why most people tend to run for things like stocks. They're sort of easier to understand when it comes to return, where that's coming from. There are other complexities behind their performance, which people probably tend to ignore, but they tend to run for stocks more than any other asset class. We've seen that in terms of flows as well, as you mentioned. If we're launching a different product from an equity-based one, the take-up tends to be quite longer versus when we give investors like an all-country world index, for instance, or a JSE index, equity index, for instance. So some investors do battle with bonds, firstly, because when I say bonds to someone, first thing they would think of is a house bond, especially in South Africa. And now I've completely lost them. But yes, bonds do have an inverse relationship with interest rates. So which is why when it comes to fixed income, which is what bonds fall under, there will always be a mention about the interest rate environment. And interest rates usually come up when we talk about inflation. So everything is actually interlinked. That's why at the intro I was talking about the levels of inflation when we were talking about bonds in July and where the SARB wants it to be, because they will target inflation instead of targeting interest rates. So they'll use the interest rates to actually go back to their targets. And those that spills out into the bond market as well, and how other asset classes tend to perform in that period. So when you purchase a bond, you're literally lending the entity that is issuing those bonds your money. So, which means in principle, they should pay you back your money at some point, your full amount, and between now and then, they should pay you interest on your money. So as you could have used that money to do something else, invest in stocks, for instance, but you chose to give them your money. So they need to give you some sort of interest. So the future point of getting your capital back is the maturity date, and the amounts that you get back periodically are your coupons. So they'll say, okay, we'll give you 10% yield on your fund. Typically, they'll divide this into two. You get your coupon in halfway through the year, and then the other one. And these are fixed amounts going forward. And then that's where some of the tricks come in, because you've got those fixed amounts based on what the interest was at that particular point. So, and the other part is that these instruments are tradable. So you can sell your bond instrument to another entity. Bond fund managers can sell it between each other, so they'll receive the interest payments. The coupons at that time are determined by what the interest rate is at that particular point, and then it's fixed for that period. And you did mention that some of these can be quite long, can be 10 years, 12 years. So now you can imagine that in an environment where rates are increased, the old bonds have a lower relative interest payment now when you're looking at the newly issued ones, which are using the new interest rate. So, and that translates to bond returns dropping.
See, I was going to say, I don't want to stray too far from that house bond example that you brought in. And let's just maybe quickly jump back to that before we carry on. If you think about it, when you buy a house and you borrow from the bank and they give you a bond, what you've actually done is you've acted like the government, right? So you've gone to the bank and you've said, I need money. I'm willing to pay you now we're going to break it because we're going to say fixed return, and it's not, because it's normally linked to prime. But just bear with me here. Let's assume it was fixed at prime. You know, well, even then that doesn't help because prime moves. But you get the idea. I'm going to pay you a return. You're going to give me money and I'm going to go do something with it. So now I'm acting as the government. The thing I'm going to go do with it is I'm going to go buy a house. The bank is going to force me to do that. They're not going to just give me free rein to go do what I want because I'm not actually the government. But basically what I've done is I've entered into a bond style arrangement with the bank. It's not that different to a government bond, really. At the end of the day, it's borrowing money and paying a return. And so if you can imagine that I went and raised money from a bank, let's say at the bottom of the pandemic, to go and buy a house when rates were really low, and I only need to pay the bank 6%, you know, lucky me. No one else is going to step in right now and take that debt over and be prepared to only earn 6%, because we are in a completely different interest rate environment now. So if the bank who lent me the money wanted to get out of this thing because they don't like me anymore or they need the money, there's no ways they can go and sell that loan off to someone else at what they originally paid for it effectively, because no one else is going to be willing to accept a 6% return from me. Heck, you can get better than that just putting your money in the bank and tying it up for a few months. So the bank, if they want to sell that bond, they will need to sell it at a much lower face value, effectively, so that whoever's buying it is buying it at a discount. And if they're buying it at a discount, then even though I'm still only paying 6% of what I borrowed, it's actually a much better return for whoever buys the bond at a discount. So if the bond was $100 and I'm paying $6, but someone goes and buys it at 60 Rand, their return is actually 10%. I was naughty there. I just chose the easy way out on the maths. But basically, their return is 10%. And the person who sells the bond, the original bank who lent me the money and sold the bond, has taken a 40% knock on their capital value, because it was okay for me to be able to do it at 6% a few years ago, but now someone wants me to pay 10%. And that's a very, I guess, different way of thinking about it. But if you can understand it in terms of debt that you're familiar with as an investor, and you scale that understanding up to government bonds and corporate bonds, that is basically how they work. When rates go up, the capital values come down. The right time to own bonds is not really when rates are going through the roof. You're not going to do nicely out of that. You're going to take big capital losses. You know, it's not going to be pretty at all. Ideally, when you want to be in bonds, I guess is what rates relatively stable slash dropping is ideal, because then you're probably going to get a capital uplift and you're probably earning a half decent yield at the same time. So I don't think the current environment is a terrible one for bonds. It certainly seems to me to be better than going and buying bonds at the absolute bottom of the pandemic. I mean, that was basically financial suicide, right?
True. I mean, your bond example is definitely a very good one. I mean, this is why banks also give you a penalty when you want to fix your bond rate going forward, especially in an environment where it's quite low in terms of the interest. In terms of what the type of environment that you just mentioned now, I mean, if you go back to when we started increasing rates in November 2021, yeah, and you look at the old bond in that period versus when SARB actually paused increasing rates in July last year, the rates, I mean, the returns that you're getting bonds are totally different. I mean, in an environment where there's a possibility of rates being cut, or as you said, stable a bit, then bonds are actually doing better. If you don't want to be in a situation where you are plowing more and more bonds in an environment where the rates are actually going up. And I mean, in an environment where reserve banks start cutting rates, then the already issued bonds have an interest payment that is higher than the newly issued, which makes bond instruments fairly attractive, appreciating their returns. The higher for longer statements that you mentioned, you have just referred to, is what has impacted bonds the most this year. And if you're looking at the last, I don't know, 8 months or so, there's been an anticipation from the markets that central banks will start cutting rates this year or whenever that started. So the higher for longer statement that you did mention, it really impacted bonds the most this year, because this year or the last 8 months. So there's been an anticipation from the markets that central banks will start cutting rates, which really pushed bonds quite significantly. I mean, in 2023, the all bond index was up 10%. So like equity-like returns that you were getting from bonds. But now they're keeping rates high for a longer time. So there has been a slowdown in bond markets. I mean, if you're looking at the year-to-date all bond index, down 2% for this year. In fact, I was reading an article yesterday that SARB might only consider cutting next year. I don't want to go down that route of predicting when the rate cuts come in. But I mean, inflation is now far from their midpoint range. They'll like it to be halfway between 3 and 6. Or even lower than that a bit, but now it's about 5%, I think, the last time they printed the numbers. So this is also seen in the international market as well. So that's why the Feds are also just pausing a bit. But a rate cut will present a good opportunity for investors to get better returns from bonds, a good time to consider bond exposure, and investors can definitely get exposure from any of our bond ETFs and unit trusts.
Yeah, the bond space is really, really interesting. I mean, if you look offshore, where they were in a much lower interest rate environment, if you think about it, let's say your rates were, we'll just use a city example. If your rate was 1% and your central bank hikes it to 2%, your rates have doubled. They've literally doubled. It's like a one-year-old turning two. That child is like twice as old as he or she was a year ago. You know, and if you've got kids, you'll see that rate of development. There's a big difference between growing from 3 to 4 versus turning, you know, 36, as I recently did. You know, that extra year really doesn't make much difference. But from 3 to 4, it makes a huge difference. Like my little guy just turned. So it's kind of the same with interest rates, you know? And the point here is that South Africa is a higher interest rate environment, effectively. So when we hike by 25 basis points or 50 or even 100 basis points, we feel it as consumers. We absolutely do. But if you think about it, the percentage change in the yields in the market is not that big. So that just makes for a bit less volatility, I think, in the bond market than you see in places like the US, for example, over that period. I mean, you might recall a while ago, we saw a sort of regional banks crisis in the US because a lot of them had gone and bought US treasuries in a low interest rate environment as part of their capital management and balance sheet management. And then, like the example I gave earlier, those bonds lose a ton of value when rates go up, and suddenly these banks find themselves with a nasty hole in their balance sheets. So the South African bond market is quite different to, you know, the developed world's bond markets in terms of volatility and exactly how they respond to rate increases and that kind of thing. And this is why fixed income is basically an entirely different section of finance to equities. And I think it really appeals to those who particularly are interested in the maths more than, you know, corporate strategy isn't really the thing that gets you any success in the bond market here. It's actually about understanding the maths and how the yields work and how the rates move and all of that kind of thing. But there's also a simplification to bonds, which is if you hold it until maturity, then you're going to get your capital back at the end that you put in, and you're going to earn the yield to maturity on which you bought that bond. If that bond is currently paying a yield to maturity of 10%, and you're going to get your money back in 10 years, that's going to be your return, unless there's a credit event, which it's very unlikely that there will be if it's a government-facing bond, etc. Can't say for sure that there won't be, because of course there's risk. That's why the South African bond yields are higher than they are in places like the US. But it is unlikely, I think we can all agree, that, you know, the South African government is going to go bankrupt. So you do get bond investors, and that's where you see stuff like retail savings bonds and that kind of thing, and big institutions who really are just looking to build a book of interest-bearing instruments, and they go and get a yield of 10% or 11%. They lock up their money for that period of time, and they're not too worried about what happens to the capital value of the bond along the way. And then you obviously get, I would think, more active investors who are actually looking at the change in price of the bond. Obviously, at an extreme, you get bond traders who are doing all kinds of fancy footwork around what is happening with interest rates and what is happening with bond prices. So bond ETFs, Sia, are really a blend of all these different yield to maturity instruments. And they give investors a way to invest in this space, I guess, get a spread of different bonds and look to add some fixed income to their portfolio. So like is almost always the case with an ETF, I think it makes things a bit easier for investors to play a certain theme. You know, if you say to yourself, we're in a high yield environment, rates are going to be relatively flat, might start going down, I want to earn a nice return in the meantime. If I get some nice capital uplift when rates go down, all the better. ETFs are pretty useful for that.
Yeah. I mean, let's just go back to what you were mentioning about yield to maturity, and I'll talk to that, and then trying to understanding this part on, in terms of what the types of investors in bonds are. And then we can also just mention the concept of ETFs in the bond space, which is quite important because, yes, they basket these different bonds with different maturities, which is quite important when it comes to the yield that you get from these. But the concept of yield to maturity is quite important, but it's often misunderstood. I mean, unless there's a credit default event, which is unlikely to the point of just you can neglect it when it comes to government debt. But the yield to maturity is what you earn if you hold the bond until it matures. So that part is quite understood. But if you want to sell a bond before it matures, you're exposed to capital risk. So this follows because even though the maturity date and interest coupon earned on the bond, they remain fixed, the price at which the bond trades in the secondary market is actually variable. So to understand why the price changes over time, consider that there are two sources of earnings from government bonds. So it's going to be your fixed interest paid per year, as well as the difference between what you paid for the bond and what you receive at the maturity. You know, you get the bond at a discount, whatever, 90% or 95% of that, and then you'll get your entire investment at the end, which is 100%. So if you paid, I don't know, 900,000 rands for a bond that pays you back 1 million in 5 years, that translates to an about 11% capital appreciation just on that bit when you're holding it to maturity. So adding this to your coupon payments, this gives you a total earnings or yield to maturity for holding that bond. So if similar maturing interest, so the five-year period is there as well, interest rates in that market actually go up, say from 10 to 12, then the existing bonds that pay a lower coupon rate will need to see a price reduction for these bonds to be attractive. So if the bond paying 1 million in 5 years now trades at 850 or 820, potential buyer would need to we'll see an additional capital return that offsets the lower interest paid compared to the bonds currently being issued at higher rates. So yeah, so this means that there are two types of bond investors, those who want to hold to maturity and know exactly what they are earning, and those looking to trade different bonds in order to earn a possible capital appreciation should interest rates in the market go down, which you'll see price of their bonds go up. So indices tracking bonds are also exposed to possible return variation as the underlying holdings actually change over time. So, and this is where the ETFs come in, because these ETFs track these different indices. So you'll get this price changes or variations in ETFs based on the fact that they're holding these underlying bonds, which have different maturities. Some of them go through a cycle of getting a better return based on what the interest is actually in that environment.
So I think, Sia, just talking about the ETFs and the way they get used in the portfolio and everything else, is the underlying exposure in there only government bonds? Is there some corporate debt in there as well, or does it depend on which fixed income ETF you actually go and choose?
Yeah, so it depends on which one you choose. Also, from ETFs, we also have unit trusts, which have indices that have bond governments and also some corporate debt. So we offer investors two local nominal bonds. So the Cetrix Gavi, which tracks the FTSE JSE All Bond Government Index. So this is all government issued bonds. And then you also have the Cetrix SA Bond, which uses an S&P index. So for those who are interested in inflation-linked bonds, which listeners remember from the conversation that we had about bonds, I think we spoke about inflation linkers and also nominal bonds. So we also have an ILB tracker. That's also an inflation-linked government index. Also, Cetrix offers a dematerialized ETF or way of getting exposure into the Namibian bonds as well, which is quite important when you're thinking of getting exposure into the Namibian market or the Namibian bonds, which is a very, very important market at the moment in terms of gas and oil exploration and how the environment is currently. So this is done using the Cetrix S&P Namibian Bond ETF, so which has been doing quite well in the last 12 to 14 months as well. So, but for exposure offshore, Cetrix offers the Cetrix Global Aggregate Bond ETF, which is a mix of government and corporate. It's one instrument that's holding, I think, over 9,000 instruments, which track global interest-bearing assets, 18% exposure to US treasuries, 10% Japanese bonds, while also including investment-grade credit instruments. So these ETFs, the advantage here is that they have no minimum entries and they're cheaper and provide liquidity for investors, which is very, very important when it comes to the bond market. But the other way to invest in bonds is through the Cetrix Balance Funds, which I mentioned, which provide a mix of assets, including stocks, bonds, and other offshore asset classes. So that's where you can also get some of the exposure of bonds.
Now, some super interesting stuff in here. And am I right that you can buy these ETFs in your tax-free savings account as well, and you go and effectively get that fixed income return tax-free? Because normally you'd obviously pay income tax on that as interest. So you'd get that kind of small annual allowance that's tax-free, and then the rest you're going to get taxed at your maximum marginal rate effectively. And there would be capital gains or losses on the bond capital value. In your tax-free account, there just won't be any tax at all. So is it correct that these ETFs are available there?
100% cost. Remember, if for any of your investments, if you earn an income from it, whether through dividends from equities, capital gains from appreciation of your investments, income from your bonds, you always need to pay tax from your gains. So your listeners will know this, or your income. So bond receives the coupons or the income that they get, so they are subject to tax. So if you have a bond in your tax-free savings accounts, you avoid paying the tax in that income you receive. So you can buy these ETFs using your tax-free savings account. In fact, I'd encourage people to think through what they want to put in their tax-free savings account, especially when it comes to tax and income. Just a blunt example, if you're a Formula One fan, which I am, you'd know that when the driver gets to a slow corner, or any corner for that matter, they always want to maximize the minimum speed through that corner. So do the same when it comes to your tax-free savings account. You maximize what you can put in it so that you can actually minimize your tax deduction from what you get from your investments. So asset types of instruments that you know will get income from it, try to push that in your tax-free savings account so that you can reduce the tax impact.
Yes, I couldn't agree with that more, honestly. I think South Africans, their first port of call should be just max your tax-free savings every year. You're basically creating a pool of money over your lifetime that you can then invest tax-free in listed stuff. Like, why would you not want to do that? You know, for me, it is just the absolute starting point. Once your savings balance is okay, next stop is tax-free savings before you start dabbling in anything else, really. And I think the one comment I just want to make there is, you know, this kind of fixed income stuff, diversification. A lot of people look at property funds for similar reasons. So a nice yield. The difference there, of course, is that in theory, it's not fixed income at all, in that, you know, that income should go up over time if things work out the way you want. And don't for a second think that that's a guarantee. We've had lots of examples of property funds where the distribution has not gone in the right direction. They are exposed to things like finance costs. They are exposed to changes in trends in properties, lease reversions, all kinds of stuff. So generally speaking, property funds are a bit of a hybrid between fixed income portfolio and a pure equity portfolio. I think they've behaved a bit more like equity actually than fixed income in the last couple of years. And they are equity. They just have this very strong yield underpin. So in my tax-free savings accounts, I try to also include a decent slug of REITs effectively, because again, REIT distributions are taxed as income. So they are taxed at the maximum marginal tax rate. But in my tax-free savings account, they are not. They are just income, and in it comes, and, you know, as per the name. And it's great. So Sia, I think this really helps to just put a spotlight on some of the different ways that people can construct their portfolios and think about these things. Satrix Now platform is, of course, a good way to do it. And I would encourage listeners to just go and read as much as they can on the topic of bonds. Go and check out the Satrix information. Go look at the fact sheets on the ETFs. It'll really help you understand a lot. And Sia, thank you for making time for this. It's always nice to chat to you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Ghost. I hope everyone was listening enjoyed the podcast.
Satrix Investments Pty Limited and Satrix Managers RF Pty Limited are authorized financial services providers. Nothing you have heard in this podcast should be construed as advice. Please do your own research and visit the Satrix website for more information on all their ETF products.